I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to The Connection. Our guest, historian Faye Bound Alberti, has face blindness. That's a neurological condition that makes it difficult to recognize familiar faces. She writes in her new book, titled The Face, about the anxiety she felt when she couldn't find her daughter in a crowd of kids. She was picking her up from nursery school and searching for something identifiable. She was only certain that she had found her daughter after hearing her voice, touching her face, and sniffing her unique scent. Faces have become so central to our identities. It's where our senses are located, which help us navigate the world, communicate, and read other people. But it wasn't always this way. In fact, until mirrors and cameras became commonplace, most people didn't really know what they looked like. Faye Bound Alberti's book traces our evolving ideas about the face from the ancient Greeks and Renaissance portraits to today with our selfie sticks and social media. She founded the Center for Technology and the Body at King's College London and joins us today on The Connection. And Faye Bound Alberti, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
You write in the book that you didn't really realize you had face blindness until you started writing this book, which is kind of amazing. So how did you navigate the world? How did you explain to yourself why it was so difficult to recognize faces that should have been so familiar to you?
Well, that's the funny thing, because most of us don't know any different, do we? We don't know any different than the kinds of upbringings we have and the kinds of capabilities we have until we are older and we look back and reflect. When I look back, I see that it was a bit baffling for me at the time that other people seemed to recognize people more easily. But I didn't realize, I didn't even know what face blindness was. I'd never heard of it. It's only now, really, since people like Brad Pitt are talking about having prosopagnosia, that we know about it and we talk about it. And when I was researching the face, I happened to do some work on facial recognition, and there were some tests online. And I thought, wait a minute, I can't do these tests. And then I had a friend who's a psychologist who's working on face blindness, and he did a scan in the MRI in the fMRI machine for me, and it started me off on a journey, really, which is enabled me to kind of map my own understanding of reading faces alongside the historical understanding. So it was a nice kind of convergence of two stories.
So how do you read faces then? And do you recognize your daughter's grown up? She's an adult now, but would you recognize
Absolutely.
Her in a crowd of other adults?
Well, I do, but if I'm seeing her out of context or out of place, it'll take me a few minutes to kind of like to realize and to process it. And the weird thing about prosopagnosia is it's a spectrum. So you have people who are really good at faces at one end, people who are not good at faces at the other. Most of us are somewhere in the middle. I have noticed that if faces are very distinctive, I do tend to remember them. But mostly I remember people through their voices or the way they move, and the sort of the shape of a person as they come towards you. And a lot of us have this feeling where we don't recognize somebody when we're not expecting to see them there. So in lots of ways, we don't really understand an awful lot about how facial recognition works. For example, I've got colleagues who work on the question of why a familiar face is familiar. How do we recognize faces as a type rather than cars, for instance? So there's still a lot we don't know. And often when I talk about my face blindness, other people get in touch with me and tell me their stories. And it's a lot more common. It's supposed to affect about 2% of the population, but I suspect it's more common than that because we don't test regularly. We don't really know.
Do you recognize your own face if you look in the mirror maybe even see a photograph of yourself in a crowd of people? Do you know what you look like?
Not always. That's the weird thing. So I was scratched on the face by a cat when I was very young, about two. And it was very deep. And I have a scar on one cheek. I can never remember which cheek it is, ever.
Really?
So what I can't do is hold a picture of my face in my mind. So I have been in shopping centres and thought, as Oliver Sacks did, why is that woman staring at me? And then I sort of realised, oh, it's me. So, you know, it's I don't automatically remember myself.
You mentioned Oliver Sacks, and I actually have a quote from an interview I did with him on a previous show that I had called Radio Times. This was 2010, and I was interviewing him, of course, a famed neurologist and writer, and he had written a book called The Mind's Eye. And I asked him about his face blindness. Let's hear what he had to say. you write about yourself that you are sometimes or have been called shy or reclusive. My social ineptitude, my eccentricity, even my Asperger syndrome, that, and I'm quoting you, as a consequence of having this face blindness. Yes.
Well, I may have all the above
the kitchen sink, isn't it?
Yeah, but when I go into a room of people, my colleagues, basically they're strangers to me. It's made worse by the fact that I sometimes have false recognitions. I was recently at a party given by a friend of mine, mm-hmm. Janet Malcolm, and she greeted me at the door, and I said, "Hi, Janet, lovely to see you again." And she coughed and said, your hostess is over there. I think I may have about sort of 10 or 15 basic categories of face, but other people have thousands of individual templates.
But what's so interesting is that you have chosen as your life profession to be a therapist. I mean, whether you're a neurologist, I know you don't want me to say psychiatrist, no. But there we go. But that you've spent your life with people, trying to understand people.
Well, among other things, I'm perfectly attuned to expressions on a face, even if I can't recognize it. And so, and of course, expressions in the voice. And there is a very close and, I hope, sympathetic scrutiny of mm-hmm. the patients as I see them.
That was Oliver Sacks back in 2010 talking about his face blindness. And to you, Faye, I mean, there's so much in there. It's only a minute and a half, and he, of course, gave us a lot to work with there. Do you think your face blindness affects your personality, sort of made you who you are in part today?
Probably. I mean, our experiences when we're younger definitely do, don't they? I know that I am very, very good at reading emotional expressions and very good at reading people. I think that people do sometimes think I'm either shy or a bit standoffish. And that's simply because I don't necessarily recognize them at first. I'm sort of frantically looking for clues. If someone comes up to me in the street and says, "Hey, Faye, haven't seen you for ages," I will frantically think about who this could possibly be. And hopefully will have worked it out by the time it's my turn to speak. But if I don't work it out, then of course you just look rude. So I think it probably affects how I approach people, you know, probably a little bit more cautiously, probably try to really interpret their emotions first. And it probably affects more how people see me and how they read my communication.
Are you good at faking it? I mean, sort of pretending like you know someone that you don't. I mean, we all do that.
Sure.
At some time in our lives,
yeah,
right?
I'm sure. Yeah, no, I have done that. And then sometimes, as Oliver Sacks said, it ended up not being someone I know at all. It just seemed much too friendly to a total stranger. So, yeah, but it's all part of the rich tapestry of human relationships, isn't it? So most people are understanding if you explain to them.
So what sparked your interest then in the face? I mean, the face, as you write, that's where our senses are. That's how we communicate with the world. That is, we're reading that in each other's faces. What's your interest?
Well, I've been a historian of emotion and the body for about 30 years now. And I was interested in the face because I thought we're so obsessed with faces now, with what we look like. If you think about social media and digital culture and so much self-esteem tangled up in our face and how we look, I wanted to know where that came from, really. And particularly for someone like me who doesn't automatically associate one face with one person, when did our sense of the person and our sense of the social value get so entangled with the face? And that's what I started tracing, really, in history through portraiture and through mirrors and cameras and the kinds of technologies that we use to, I suppose, to track and evaluate and record other people and ourselves.
I've said this several times, and every time I came across it in the book, I had to sort of stop and think, which for most of human history, we humans have not really known what we look like.
Yeah.
And I think it stops you in our track because we so know what we look like now.
Yeah.
The contrast could not be greater.
That's right. I mean, you think about how many mirrors most of us have in our homes, or the fact that we're constantly checking ourselves in our phones. Yeah, and it wasn't until really the 17th century that mirrors started to become more common. They've been used in the ancient world by, you know, very wealthy people, and, you know, obsidian was used as a mirror. But what's really interesting is it's not until probably mass production in the 19th century that becomes ubiquitous, and they are everywhere. But in the 18th century, there's much more focus on what people look like and all kinds of grooming and fashion and obsession with things like eyebrows and moles and makeup. And so we have this emergence of consumer culture and the growth of towns and the busyness of our social lives and the anonymity of people that we've never had before until that point, and at the same time much more concerned with what we look like. But it's bizarre when you imagine that for most of history we didn't see our reflections, even as we saw it in a pool of water or an agricultural tool, the metal of agricultural tool. And you must think, gosh, how differently must we have engaged with the world? Right. Because when we have a conversation, we're often, I mean, even on Zoom, if we can see ourselves at all, we think about how we look and how we're coming across, less so on the other person. So I think it's really interesting to reflect on how it shaped our sense of self and our social relationships, being so preoccupied with what we look like.
Well, I would assume part of that was how others, if we didn't know what we looked like, then how others reacted to us. I mean, they didn't know what they looked like either. I'm trying to sort of figure out the scenario, but that did give us a little bit of feedback, it seems, before we knew what we looked like.
Yeah, and that would really put most of the emphasis on emotional communication, wouldn't it? And being able to, and that is the most fundamental part of the human face. And unlike any other animal and any other primate, we've got the most evolved muscles in the face to be able to make a wide range of facial expressions, because the communicative function of the face is the most important thing. And that's one of the things that I really stress in the book, is that we've started to think about the face as a commodity that can be changed and enhanced and improved in search of some sort of perfection. But it's really about our sort of human engagement with other people, which is why focusing on them in a conversation is, I think, you're much more likely to have connection than if you think about what you look like.
We're almost up on a break here, but our faces also are, if we haven't, had cosmetic surgery, is our lived experience. It's the scars we have, as you described, the wrinkles we have, how our nose, fits between our cheeks, that kind of thing. I mean, it is our geography.
It is. And that notion of having the family nose, or the sort of, looking at the resemblance that we have with our families and our children. It's a sort of an inheritance that connects us to others just through that sort of physical shape. But you mentioned cosmetic surgery, and it's become so ubiquitous, particularly after the pandemic.
Yeah, you know what? Hold on to that thought, only because we are up at a break, and I do want to get to cosmetic surgery because it is so ubiquitous these days. Mm. And again, our guest is Faye Bound Alberti. She's got a new book. It's titled The Face, A Cultural History, and we are talking about our faces, our identities, the fact that she has something called face blindness, which makes it difficult for her to recognize faces that are actually familiar. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. For most of human history, we had no idea what we looked like. There were no cameras, there were no mirrors, no selfies. Today, of course, it's a very different story. So today on the show, I'm talking with historian Faye Bound Alberti about her new book titled The Face. She traces the history of facial imagery and how it has become so central to our identity. Faye, you talk about something called facehood. This is, and you mentioned portraiture and the Renaissance and the fact that wealthy people could hire famous artists or soon to be famous artists to paint their portrait. What do you mean by facehood?
Well, I felt that facehood was a useful way of explaining how you have this equation now between one face and one person, a kind of idea that our face is our unique sign of ourselves. And we use it in everything from passports to identity cards or to unlock our phones. But it's extraordinary to think that even though we have photography from the 1840s, it's not actually until the First World War that people started using photographs as being mandatory in passports, which is quite extraordinary. And there was a whole conversation before photographs were used in passports about whether maybe it should be fingerprints, or maybe it should be gait, or maybe it should be something else, like the measurement of a person's arm. So what we find in the I suppose the history of urbanisation and the history of colonisation is this desire to categorise and classify people. And with the 19th century and the Victorians, you get a desire to categorise people by type, which has all sorts of implications for race and ethnicity and the hierarchy of beings. But it also means that more and more attention is focused on the unit of the face as this thing that marks us out as quite different. So for me, coining the idea of facehood was a way of explaining that shorthand and also drawing attention to the fact that it wasn't inevitable. Mm. It wasn't essential or inevitable that we would focus on the face. There are so many other things that we could focus on. But the journey you're describing from the Renaissance onwards is more focus on the face in terms of showing the world who we are.
But it's not the face. I mean, if we were to show our hand or our elbow, I mean, that would not be a signifier. As you say, there is so much in the face that is uniquely ours.
It is, absolutely. But our technologies have all evolved to recognise that. And that's often the case, I think. This is why I find the face such an interesting subject of study, because often we take it for granted that it's inevitable, it has to be the face. And yet it could have been gait analysis, or it could have been scent, or it could have been fingerprints, or some other kind of biometric. And what's interesting to me is the ways in which those choices were made. Because, for instance, fingerprinting was considered not... it wasn't something that people would accept very easily. It required specialist equipment. You couldn't do it from a distance. But you couldn't categorise faces until you had photography. And so those sorts of the desire to capture and photograph and fix people and categorise them came about at the same time as the technology to do it.
Well, let me ask you about photography, because obviously now we're all carrying cameras and our phones these days. But going back even to the 19th century, you write that Frederick Douglass was the most photographed man in the 19th century, more than Abraham Lincoln. So Frederick Douglass must have known something about the face, about the power of portraiture.
Yeah.
And he was a very handsome man, so I think that sort of helped send out that message. Yeah. But talk a bit more about him.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it extraordinary how photographed he was? And that's a recognition of the power of photography, of being able to summarise who a person was, but also to tap into that much earlier tradition of portraiture that is about showing someone is noble and has bearing and is civilised. Because for most of history, black people were not... depicted at all in portraiture. And what we find in the history of portraiture is that very early on in the ancient world, there are archetypal images of rulers. So they tend to have very characteristic traits that are meant to show capabilities and type of person rather than the individual difference. So you have the strong chin and the sort of the straight nose and the big eyes that show you have vision. With the Renaissance, there's much more interest in humanism and individual difference and personality. So you have more of an emphasis on people starting to look like the people that they are representing rather than just symbols. And then when you have photography, you have more and more ordinary people wanting to be shown. So that is part of a transition, which by the 19th century, Frederick Douglass was absolutely aware of the power of what it meant, of sitting in front of a camera and being depicted as a way of being able to disseminate that quite easily among people and to show that you are worthy of taking notice of. So it's a very powerful act to be photographed in that way.
Indeed. I mean, he knew how to wield power like almost nobody else. But I always wonder, with those portraits from the Renaissance that are so famous, did those people really look like that? Or was that the artist, you know, putting the sort of best light on perhaps a face that was not quite so beautiful?
Yes. Well, you'll know the Anne of Cleves story with Henry VIII when... people used to use portraits as a way of brokering a marriage. So you couldn't know what a person looked like, you'd send a portrait. And Anne of Cleves did not look as beautiful in the flesh, apparently, as Henry VIII anticipated. And the marriage was annulled soon after it took place. And so that's the most famous example. Or another one is Oliver Cromwell, of course, who said he wanted to be painted with his warts. You know, he didn't want any airbrushing. He didn't want any covering up of who he really is. But I think you're absolutely right, of course. In the Renaissance, rulers would have been painted to look at their best, to have the, you know, airbrushed in the same way that we might filter things today when we put images of ourselves on Instagram. People have always wanted to look as good as they could. So you've always got that slight tension between how a person wants to be portrayed and how they really look. But we still have more focus on individual personality in the post-Renaissance period, less on symbols. So symbols, if you think about all of the ways that people would depict themselves to show that they were a ruler or show that they were religious. So that traditionally it was more about a symbol of a person rather than a physical face and what their individual difference was.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Faye Bound Alberti. She is a historian, also the author of a new book that we're talking about called The Face, A Cultural History. You also write that the very first selfie was taken in 1839 here in Philadelphia by a guy named Robert Cornelius.
Yes, that's
a selfie,
right.
And you include his photograph, and it has a very selfie look about it, I should say.
Yes, he's actually a very handsome young man who was trying to reduce the amount of time that he'd have to stand in front of the camera. Because actually, what's quite funny is that if you think about those Victorian pictures where people look terribly stiff, it's because they've had to stand there for about 7 minutes, keeping the same pose. And you can imagine no one's going to be smiling after that. But I love that image of Cornelius because what's fascinating is that it's a very modern looking. He looks like a sort of new romantic or something, doesn't he? A sort of very handsome man standing in his backyard of the lighting business that he had. And that image has been circulated all over social media as a kind of as an example of the first selfie. And everybody's talking about how hot he is, which he certainly would never have imagined back in the day.
Well, let's talk about selfies. And of course, you know, it's they're everywhere. And it is a way that we communicate with each other and group selfies, individual selfies. Mm-hmm. You also talk about during the pandemic when we would see these, you know, have to be online at a Zoom meeting and all those little boxes of faces. And there among those faces is our own. And we're either staring at us saying, uh-oh, or we put a big, you know, we blank it out so we don't have to look at it. Talk us through that.
Yeah, so that there have actually been a whole wave of new surgeries since the pandemic, things like Zoom neck and Zoom chin, because people don't normally spend time looking at their own faces when they're in conversation. And I have a very good friend who works in health economics, and she said to me, I've just realized how big my nose is. All I do is spend my time on Zoom looking at my nose. And she didn't have a big nose, but these things can become obsessive, can't they? Because it's not normal to look at ourselves in that way the whole time. Although in lots of ways the technologies like Zoom allow us to have relationships and connections around the world, they also change our relationship with our face in subtle ways. And it strikes me just how many selfies most people take today, and that process of airbrushing and perfecting that a lot of people do as though we're not enough on our own. It's really quite alarming. And certainly we know that the rise of visual social media like Instagram has been accompanied by a growth in cosmetic surgery, and also cosmetic surgeons use Instagram, and so it's a bit of a tangled knot, really, that countries are only just starting to come to terms with in terms of what they do about it and what kind of restrictions should be in order. But it's a very easy sort of rabbit hole to fall down.
Well, it's interesting that Narcissus looked, you know, in the pool of water and he liked what he saw. But I think most people will look in a mirror and they will not like what they see, or they wish they had a different nose, or they see, you know, the ravages of time on their face.
Yeah.
I mean, there's
yes, absolutely.
The level of dissatisfaction, really, I think, gets higher and higher.
Yeah, I think it's that compare and despair culture is very pronounced, isn't it? And I think you're right that Narcissus fell in love with his own reflection, which is why we have this name narcissism for excess sort of love of the self. But most of the time when we look at ourselves, it's to pick fault, particularly for women and particularly for young women. And I think now that there is a sort of supposed answer, which has been since the 1950s through cosmetic surgery, but increasingly post-pandemic is different kinds of ways of surgically enhancing our face. Even the language of enhancement itself is an issue. It's become so tangled up in if there's something wrong with us, rather than just, oh, this is part of us, or everybody's different. It's rather more, how do we look like that person, or how do we improve ourselves in a very stylized way, which homogenizes people. And that's the thing that I find quite sad as well, is that actually the notion of what is beautiful has become so limited and so, it's homogenous. It's a very kind of particular type.
The
And I'm sure
puffy
that there'll be.
lips and the cheekbones that look like they have something built inside
Well,
them.
and all the fillers and the sort of static faces, and of course now we're hearing that Botox actually is supposed to migrate to the brain perhaps, and we don't really know what the long-term implications are. So all the time we're almost creating our faces to be as unfeeling as possible, whereas that's the whole point of them, is that they are to communicate and express what you want to say. And I think that the looks maxing phenomenon is very much kind of caught up in this, of course, which I'm sure that a lot of your listeners will be aware of, is what is happening to young men in terms of what you were saying with chiseled cheekbones and square jaws. And it is a very white kind of imperialist idea of beauty in both men and women, but it's the idea that your value, and they have a whole social value that looks maxes that's reducible to a number on a scale about how what's your worth. And I think what's important about that too is that we've always done this in theory. So in the ancient world, there was this idea that what you looked like on the outside reflected who you were on the inside, so physiognomy. But that's come back into fashion with social media because it's a very easy shorthand, isn't it?
Well, and as you write, that people who are considered attractive are considered to be kinder, smarter, better, to have all those qualities that go with that. And I wanted to pick up on face maxing, and this is a very disturbing phenomenon, I would say, among young men or young adult men. I mean, I think we should say that most men do not do this, but some people are, to the point where they might take a hammer and smash some of the bones in their face in order to make it look a certain kind of way. There's also a thing called what, hunter eye, hunter's
Hunter
eye. So
eyes, hunter
you look
eyes.
like you're on the, I guess you're out on the prowl with your hunter eyes.
Which is part of the manosphere and the whole sort of the growth that we've seen in misogyny, but also a kind of it's a self-hatred that I think is really quite challenging and hopefully is on the way out. I think there's definitely it's changing. But the idea is that if you smash your face with a hammer, the bones will grow back bigger and more pronounced. And there's no basis in science at all. And actually, things like TikTok have introduced restrictions now on people being able to say that it is. But the notion of a hunter eye, which means a sort of hooded eye, as opposed to a kind of the wide eye of a prey animal, like Timothée Chalamet has, I suppose, prey eyes technically. Then the idea is that you're not as masculine and you're much more feminine, and it's bundled up in these ideas about your value as a man, which you can imagine for a kind of disaffected young people who don't actually have a lot of economic capital in the world. It's very powerful, this idea that this is what you need to do to be loved. And I do think this is part of the whole issue around the loneliness epidemic and a sort of sense of a very an anxious generation, as has been said. All of these things are interconnected.
You know, what's interesting is thinking that the face is the individual. This is who I am. This is my face. Take it or leave it. And then the idea of cosmetic surgery, which is that my face ra looks rather like the face the same doctor did to someone else, that it has a sort of very familiar look to it. And I think we sort of know what that face looks like.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we've all seen the Mar-a-Lago face that we see, that's been talked about, with a very sort of, and it's a deliberately enhanced face with, as you said, very kind of plumped and lineless and big lips, and it's to show the sort of wealth that you have by the sort of work that you can do on your face. You're right, absolutely, that different, there's a very particular technique and very particular styles, and so it's become very homogenized, even when it's supposed to be expressing individuality. And what I think is also interesting is that we had a whole generation of women who were doing lip fillers and implants and wanting to look like the Kardashians. Then the Kardashians dissolved all of their fillers, and then you have, a whole generation of girls who are hoping to find the money to do the same thing. But then also, of course, very famously, Kris Jenner has a very expensive facelift. So I think the interesting thing is that there's something happening in terms of those sorts of changes becoming less visible and wealth showing itself through slightly more invisible, has she or has she not, sort of ways. So we're always chasing this idea of what we should look like, but it's always based on access to resources and opportunities, and so we can't win. We can never win. And also, the more surgery we do or the more enhancements we make, the worse we feel. And I always think it's like when you do up your kitchen and suddenly your front room looks really shabby. It's comparative,
That's
and
exactly right.
people do get. So it has an addictive quality. So, you might get the Botox, but then should you have fillers, or you can take Ozempic, which we know is going to lose all your fat from your face, and clinics will supply it because they know you'll come back for the skin tightening procedures. So it's all this that we're on endlessly chasing our tails in the belief, as you said earlier, that then we will be loved more and valued higher.
Well, we're almost having a break here, but I will admit, who hasn't looked in front of the mirror
Oh,
and just kind of pulled their cheeks up just to
I
see,
know.
how
We all do
would this look like if I were to
it.
go under the knife? And in fact, you and I want to talk about this after this very short break, because you did talk to some plastic surgeons and you did
I
say to
did.
one, well, what would you do if given free rein? So let's take that short break, Faye Bound Alberti, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about the human face. We all have one, and she's written a book called The Face, and it's subtitled A Cultural History. She founded the Center for Technology and the Body at King's College London, where she leads Interface. That's the world's first and only multi-million-dollar project examining technologies of the face. Much more to talk about after this short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoena, and today on The Connection, how the face became so central to our identity. If you're just joining us, our guest is Faye Bound Alberti. She is a historian and founder of the Center for Technology and the Body at King's College London. She also has a new book called The Face, and she also has face blindness, something that we talked about at the beginning of the show, and that's a neurological condition that makes it difficult for her to recognize familiar faces. So you did talk to some plastic surgeons, and you did, I give you some bravery award for this. You did say to one of them, so what would you do if given free rein? So what did that person say?
Well, just for context, so I work with a lot of plastic surgeons. I have for many years now, and some of them are terrific. I was concerned that some of them were opportunistic. And at that time, 20 years ago, when I worried less about my looks in the mirror than I do now, as is normal with aging.
Sure.
I went to see a cosmetic surgeon on Harley Street in London because I was aware that we had these mother-daughter deals in the US, in the UK, sorry, where you could, get your breasts done and get an extra pair for your daughter for free. And
You're
I was so
kidding.
horrified about that. No, I'm not.
This is your medical system, your healthcare system, right?
Isn't that extraordinary? Buy one, get one free, breast enhancements. So I was also interested in the fact that when people go for cosmetic surgery, they're vulnerable and they are feeling bad about themselves. And there's a very strong power imbalance because you've got somebody in a white coat who is, talking to you about how you look as though it's a kind of objective measure.
Right.
rather than a social one, or an often a gendered one, because most of the men. And in the UK at the time too, they had the problem where the salespeople would wear white coats, and it was not very easy to know where, you know, where does the doctor part begin and end. So it was a real problem for a long time, and we still are quite unregulated, as lots of countries are when it comes to cosmetic surgery. So I went to Harley Street and I had an appointment, and I wanted to know what it was felt like to be in that kind of, in that situation with a doctor. So I stripped off and I stood there and they said, what would you do?
Wow.
I wouldn't ask it now. I wouldn't ask it now. And it was extraordinary because it was all about, we'll take the fat from your hips and your butt and we'll put it in your breasts and your cheeks and we'll lift this and we'll tuck that. And she said, and she gave me a sort of projected invoice, and it was, I think it was £17,000. And I said, and you buy a small house in Middlesbrough at that point for that money. And then I said, how long would it last? And she would say, a decade if you're lucky. And I thought, wow. And also each of those procedures would be painful, would take time to heal and get well. And you have all kinds of hazards that through my research, and I've found out much more about it since, but, you know, these are not they're not as easy as putting a filter on. You know, they are massive changes that we're making to our body, and they carry risk. And there's an idea that if we only would look like this, then we would be happier. But it's not the reality. Most people don't feel happier afterwards. And there might well be something they've always worried about. And maybe it feels like a quicker fix that way. But most of the time we're chasing something that's completely impossible, which is self-acceptance.
Sure. And something you mentioned earlier, talking about portraiture in the Renaissance, and the idea that, you know, an eyebrow could mean something, or the makeup had some significance, which sounds very much like what we're talking about today. The sort of details of the face or the body become so significant.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that what we're seeing now as well, with young women being able to do the most extraordinary contouring and makeup and transforming their faces, and the things that makeup artists can do, the thing that you can do with prosthetics, the thing that we can do with digital filters, there's an extraordinary sense of, in one sense, ownership of the face, that we can transform ourselves to make it look exactly like we like. And on the other hand, as you said before, it's when we're making ourselves more homogenized, the interesting spaces is when we are trying to do something that's really quite unusual and different, I think, which is almost like reclaiming the face a bit. And I mean, it is quite sort of radical to sort of feel okay about wrinkles now, which isn't that an extraordinary thing,
that
it's okay
hair.
To get old. Yeah, exactly. So I'm interested in the ways in which people, in the same way that there's more overweight and fat bodies being talked about as, you know, this is normal, there are more people now saying, no, it's okay to have wrinkles, and it's okay to, you know, to show that we are aging. And I think that's one of the terrible things that happens to women, is that we become invisible, we become irrelevant. And of course we internalize that. And of course we want to chase the idea of looking younger, but it doesn't really get us anywhere. And the power, I think, lies in being able to step outside that. Which is tough.
It is tough for women, but I also think for men as well, and because we do put so much stock in our appearance. But I wanted to, with cosmetic surgery, whether not only do you sort of lose sight of, well, what does a 40-year-old look like, or 50-year-old, or 60-year-old, or 70-year-old, but also the fact that most people are not going to, you know, do what the Kardashians apparently do on a regular basis. So we are stuck with our bodies and our faces. And then we feel badly because we don't look the way we're supposed to look, you know, based on all this celebrity status.
Yes, that's right. I think that's right. So we're consuming all of this information all the time about what we should look like on celebrity magazines and celebrity, you know, Instagram feeds and so on. But certainly it's changing. If you think about, I think the Golden Girls were all in their 50s, weren't they? And yet now we have, you know, a 50-year-old woman is supposed to look very different. And yet we have that misogyny tangled up with it, where you look at how Madonna looks and her transformations and the kind of vitriol that she gets and called grandma. So there's constantly all of these social complexities and entangled in it. I think the interesting thing about men is there is this drive now towards men having facelifts, but the quest is about wanting to look younger, because then they feel more virile, because then they feel more economically relevant. So there's almost like, one is women pursuing beauty because then they'll be loved, and the other is men pursuing youth because then they'll be seen as viable economically. So they're very traditional patriarchal values that are kind of being fed through the idea of the face. But yeah, it's an awful lot of pressure that we're all put under all the time.
But it's interesting to think of, attractiveness is such a broad, vague term, as you say, in part based on the sort of Greek notion of the triangle face. Although when you look at people today and people that, who are considered attractive, I think there's a pretty large gamut, Zendaya to Meryl Streep. I mean, there's a
Absolutely.
Lot. There's a lot of, those are two very different looking faces. But I also think attractiveness is personality and charisma and... Yeah. As you say, paying attention to other people, that makes someone a more attractive person.
Absolutely. I think that's right. And it's the diversity, actually, that makes people beautiful, diversity of humanity. And I think it's also really important to remember that we look at these faces and they're static and still. But actually, it's faces in conversation and communication. It's faces emoting. It's talking. There's such a wide variety of things that make us attractive to other people than a sort of what a static face looks like.
I wonder, too, if we could talk a bit about, AI and deep fakes. I mean, we're living more and more in a world where we don't know if something that we see online is real or not real. Throw the face or the body into that. And you can be hijacked and kidnapped, essentially, and have your face and identity stolen from you.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that is happening so fast as well. And so many of those digital technologies are happening so much more quickly than we have the ability to legislate against them. And certainly deepfakes, obviously a massive issue for the film industry and for women who are being used for, revenge pornography and all the rest of it. I think this is a really troubling area that we still need to really be able to get an understanding of and properly legislate against. I also think that there are lots of ways in which we are using AI technologies through, say, conversational avatars that are potentially beneficial. So I think that there's an issue here about how do we decide which are the ways in which AI and enhancement and creation of artificial faces is going to help us and enhance our experience in the same way that social media might enhance the experience of someone who's very shy. And what are the ways in which they will actually make us feel more disembodied and disconnected and can pose a potential threat? And I think those are the kind of obviously the most pressing questions that we have at the moment in this field.
Well, and you think of there are ranges of therapy or conversation, but sometimes it's very compelling to talk to an AI, therapist, if I can put it that way. And they're very sympathetic and sometimes even help people through some really difficult parts of their life.
Yeah, I think they definitely have a place, and they have a place which is that a lot of the time, if people are, going round and round about something and they need reassurance and validation and to a degree companionship, it can be really healthy and enrich their lives. And what I discovered through my work on loneliness is that actually those sorts of technologies, when they are accompanied by in real life relationships, they can actually enhance their lives and make them better. The worrying thing is when they supplant it entirely and you have nothing else, and then you have no sense of proportion or reality, and we give these AI agents that have no humanity or real sense of what it is to be an embodied person in the world. We give them a kind of a knowledge, or we sense that they know more than they do. And of course, that we've seen that can be very dangerous for young people when they trust them as therapists. And we've seen that people can fall in love with these disembodied agents because they project onto them all of the wishes that they want in the real world. And that tension, for me, that tension between the digital world, which is not at all about the body, and the real world, which is all body, is where we have these really fascinating ethical issues that we still have to work through as a society. And I think these kind of conversations are really important for helping us do that.
I mean, we're always making judgments on people's faces. I mean, their body language, their voice, but largely on their faces. I mean, where does that come from? Where do we decide that this is a face, a trustworthy face, and this is someone we should stay away from? What are we looking at?
The idea of it really comes back from physiognomy in the ancient world. And The Bible, for instance, was talking about how it's all about colour and whiteness is about goodness. And so what happens is you have these traditional ideas about colour and purity, and they become overlaid with these ideas about morality and ethics and the face and virtue. So historically, we have these parallel strands. We've got one religious strand, which is talking about you shouldn't have any sort of disfigurement because then you're not fit to enter the temple. And this this ancient Greek strand, which is all about, you know, this person's a good ruler because they've got a square jaw and a straight nose and large eyes. And what happens is that over time almost becomes forgotten about, because then, you know, the Middle Ages, for example, is all about symbolism and it's about ritual and it's very rich on kind of colour. Mm. And it's less focused on the person. It's more focused on religion. And it's only really when we have the Renaissance, when all of those ancient Greek texts were refound and refocused on, that we have physiognomy coming back in. And what's happened in the Victorian period onwards is that we've taken those texts as saying something absolutely real about evolutionary psychology and what is the only way of viewing other people, and we've internalized them. And I think it's a shame, because we take for granted that we can judge a person and decide if they are, you know, trustworthy enough to hire or mm-hmm. marry, or even we find in trials whether or not a person is guilty of murder, which is terrifying when you think how racist a lot of systems are, or, you know, the ways in which we make presumptions about a person based on their facial expression. And I'm not saying that you can't learn something from faces and body language. Of course right. you can, but it's not as scientific or determined as we have made it. And the more that we focus on that, the more it becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, and it becomes impossible to think outside of it. Whereas we know now from neuroscientific science, for instance, that actually, you know, emotional expressions, they're not universal. They mean different things in different contexts. As we age, our faces say different things. We might have mixed feelings. It's just not as cut and dried as we think. And I think we need to disentangle some of those associations.
Well, and some people are very expressive with their facial yeah. expressions, and some people yeah. kind of keep it really close yeah. to the vest. They're hard to read. Yeah. Doesn't mean they're not yeah. feeling it. They're just not
no.
broadcasting it, you know, to
yeah.
everybody else.
Absolutely. One of the things I talk about in the book is a friend of mine called Kathleen Bogart, she's now a very esteemed psychologist. And when she was a child, she didn't cry or emote when she was first born. And the doctor said, oh, she has failure to thrive and you should put this child in an institution.
Oh my goodness.
And this was in 1981 in the US. And what it was is that she has Möbius syndrome, which is it's when the facial nerves don't develop in the same way as they do normally. And so as a result, she cannot make facial expressions. And people have made all kinds of associations and assumptions about people who can't make facial expressions over the centuries. And thankfully, her parents ignored what the doctor said, and she went on to succeed. But it is interesting also cultural differences, because if you think about Japanese culture, there's far less focus on very effusive emotion than there is compared to American culture. It doesn't mean that people are feeling differently. It just means that there's a code, there's a way of communicating. But we still make a lot of presumptions about people based on what we expect and what we think people should be emoting like.
Well, and we're almost up at a break. I mean, we're almost up at the end of the show, I should say. But that's the feedback that we get when someone yeah. is emoting. Mm. Something yes. is we believe something is registering and it's giving yeah. us some feedback for our own self.
Yes, absolutely. Which takes us back to the communication role of the face. And as children born into any culture, we learn how to emotionally communicate. We learn, you know, what facial expressions gets us care, which ones make people avoid us. And that, you know, complex ongoing relationship in how we communicate is just, it's a fundamental part of being human. And we're disrupting that all the time, where we're seeking to modify it and make it as blank and as uniform as possible.
So are you comfy with your face?
Am I comfy with my face?
Yeah.
Did you say?
Yeah.
I don't know how it's interesting. It's a really interesting question. Because I don't have that sort of relationship with my face. So I notice it's aging. I think, oh, I show too much of my emotion on the face. I'm very conscious of that. Right. But I don't think I have the same relationship as a lot of people because of my face blindness, I guess.
Well, we got to leave it there. Faye Bound, Alberti, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, her book is titled The Face, and it's subtitled A Cultural History. And again, founded the Center for Technology and the Body at King's College London. She also writes for Time Magazine, The Guardian, and other publications as well. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Debbie Bilder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.